Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Susan Yawkey reporting. Humanitarian disaster reported in Fallujah. Exhausted, hungry, and desperate, 30,000 people have poured out of Fallujah in the past 3 days as Iraqi forces stormed into the center of the city, pushing Islamic State fighters into the northwest of the city. Despite the searing Iraqi summer heat, many of those who have escaped are sleeping out in the open as refugee camps are now full. Others have managed to find refuge in warehouses or mosques. Russian President Vladimir Putin said he agrees with an American proposal to incorporate opposition representatives in Syria's government, but balked at the idea that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad should step down immediately. During a wide-reaching interview with CNN at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, Putin said the only way to ensure that democracy takes hold in Syria is with a new constitution and new elections at all levels of government based on that constitution. Tens of thousands of people have protested the presence of U.S. military bases on the Japanese island of Okinawa after an American contractor and former Marine was accused of raping and killing a local woman. The rally today called for a review of the U.S.-Japanese security agreement. Jeff Kingston is a professor of Asian study and history at Temple University's Japan campus.
They feel so frustrated. You know, they've put up with a lot for a very long time. Nobody seems to listen. And so I think that these protests are not going to just go away. They're not going to die down.
Okinawa Governor Takeshi Onaga joined today's rally and apologized for failing to protect the young woman who died. We invite you to visit our website at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Belgium has carried out major security sweeps, and prosecutors said they are charging 3 suspects with terrorist activity. This comes hours after the country's National Security Council met to review mounting evidence of an imminent attack. Prime Minister Charles Michel said Belgium would remain extremely vigilant hour by hour, but there were no major incidents involving Belgium's Euro 2016 football match Saturday, which some had feared might be a target for militants. Belgium has remained under a terror alert since the attacks in March on the Brussels airport and subway that killed 32 people. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says detention is not the answer to Europe's refugee crisis and should end immediately. Mr. Ban met with refugees from war, terrorism, and poverty on the Greek island of Lesbos.
The challenge is growing. Every day around the world, thousands of families continue to flee their homes. Every month, 450 people lose their lives in the Mediterranean Sea.
The UN chief called on European countries to respond to the crisis with a humane and human rights-based approach. Tens of thousands of migrants from Syria, Afghanistan, and other trouble spots are in camps in Greece, hoping to find permanent homes in the European Union. President Obama stressed his administration's efforts to improve the environment during a visit to Yosemite National Park, but said much more needs to be done to safeguard the natural beauty of such preserves.
Here in Yosemite, meadows are drying up. Bird ranges are shifting farther northward. Alpine mammals like pikas are being forced further upslope to escape higher temperatures. Yosemite's largest glacier, once a mile wide, is now almost gone.
The president and his family drove through dense forest, enjoying the views in the nation's oldest national park. Yosemite is more than 3,000 square kilometers of mostly undeveloped wilderness. Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican U.S. presidential nominee, is complaining that some Republicans are trying to thwart the official declaration of his nomination at next month's National Party Nomination Convention. Some delegates say they want to change the party's rules to allow delegates to vote for someone other than the brash billionaire real estate mogul. Trump's opponents say he does not represent the Republicans' traditional conservative policy positions that he comments about as women, Muslims, and Mexicans makes him unacceptable as the Republican standard bearer. The U.S.-based giant aviation corporation Boeing has reached an agreement with Iran to sell the country 100 passenger planes. Iran's aviation authority announced today the deal is one of 3 separate agreements made between Iran and Western plane makers for a total of around 200 aircraft. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clawton in Washington.
Employees of the public sector, is not a thing, it is not new that they all the time they go on a strike. So striking by the public sector is not a new thing, it is something common all over the world.
A top South Sudanese official says a section of the international community seeks a regime change.
We have normal trade relations. We'd like to see them expand. And that's why last year, my distinguished predecessor, Ambassador Wharton, took a business delegation to the U.S.
The United States and Zimbabwe enjoy good trade relations despite sanctions against President Robert Mugabe and his inner circle.
This strategy will place greater focus on preventing and managing medical complications caused by Zika virus infection by providing counseling and treatment, if necessary, to pregnant women, partners, households infected.
And the World Health Organization appeals for $121 million to combat the Zika virus. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The South Sudanese Information Minister says a section of the international community is undermining the government in Juba by turning civil society groups and public sector workers against the administration seeking regime change. This after public sector workers embarked on a strike to pressure the government for their unpaid salaries. But Information Minister Michael Makuei told me that it is not true that workers have not been paid for the last several months.
Well, of course, for employees of the public sector, it's not strange, it is not new that they all the time they go on a strike. So striking by the public sector is not a new thing, it is something common all over the world. And as we have heard, there are some institutions, there are some public workers who are already on a strike, others are likely to follow. All these things are being done on the pretext that their salaries have not been paid. Others have been exaggerating it, saying people have not been paid for 4 months, others are for 5 months and so forth, which is not true. There is an agitation going on from certain sectors against the government of South Sudan. These sectors now are the ones which are agitated, and some are already on strike, others are on the way. Anyway, the government of South Sudan is doing its level best, and within this coming week, they will be paid, or everybody will be paid his salary, if it is a question of the salary. And thereafter, it will be clear to us as to what are the intentions. Because if it is a question of salary, the salary will be paid this coming week. If it is another thing, then it will be clear and we'll know what it is.
What do you mean if it's another thing? What is that other thing you're talking about?
Well, of course, there are some members of the international community who are now agitating here, agitating the civil society, the public servants, to go on strike. This is something orchestrated in order to declare the government a failed government. This is something to do with the policy of a regime change. This is what we know. There are certain elements within the international community that are doing this, and we know them.
Mr. Information Minister, but if the public sector workers have not been paid and they are saying the government has failed them because they put in work and they are required to be paid a certain amount of money and the money is not coming, don't you think they have a legitimate reason to say the government has failed them?
Yes, we don't deny that. The government of South Sudan has some financial or economic problems that need to be addressed. And the government is doing its level best to ensure that this situation is addressed. So there are certain elements that have entered now to agitate, using that as an excuse for achieving their objective.
Well, once you are already aware that this is the objective to have a regime change, why wouldn't the government redouble its efforts to prevent that from happening by making sure?
As I stated, we are redoubling our effort. This is why I said we are paying the public sector next week.
Well, I hear the judges will also begin their strike possibly next week. How do you address that challenge, Mr.
The demand of the judges, that is not correct. The demand of the judges is not because of the delay of salary or not because they are not paid, but they have their own demands. They have demands of improvement of their conditions of service, on their allowances, and so forth and so forth. So their demands are completely different. They have nothing to do with what others are doing. Despite that, the government is now trying its level best to address some of the concerns of the judges are being addressed, that is it. Among them was the question of promotions. Some of the promotions have been made.
Following the meeting of Council of Ministers with President Salva Kiir, what was the directive concerning the payment of the workers?
The general directive to the Ministry of Finance and the Central Bank as the economic sector was to sit and see how best the government of South Sudan will solve this economic situation. This is the general decision. It has nothing to do with the pay.
They were also saying that they see senior government officials driving in very luxurious cars and living very lavishly. And so when the government said there's no money, that is why they question the authenticity of what the government is saying. And they said there's also corruption that a government has failed to fight and all that. And that is why they're raising those concerns. You don't think those concerns are legitimate?
This is why I'm saying this. There are people who have other objectives other than the reality. The luxurious cars which are alleged to be being used by the ministers were not just bought soon. These are luxurious cars which were bought those days when the government of South Sudan had the necessary resources. So there is nothing new about the luxurious cars which people are talking about. Number one. Number two, the question of ministers being seen to be leading luxurious life, that is not true, is not correct. Those people who just talk like that are those agitators who have ill intentions. They are not genuine, they are not serious, and these are mere statements which are not substantiated. Ministers are usually the last to be paid.
Why wouldn't you name those agitators who you say are in the international community seeking regime change? Why wouldn't you name them?
Well, they are already there. They know themselves. We know them. We don't need to talk about them. We will talk to them, and we know what we are doing.
Michael Makuei is the South Sudanese Information Minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Juba. United States Ambassador to Zimbabwe Harry Thomas Jr. says America and Zimbabwe enjoy good trade relations despite targeted sanctions imposed on President Robert Mugabe and his inner circle more than a decade ago. For VOA reporter Ivan Chafera has the details from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Responding to questions from the public at a function organized by social media enterprise 263 Chat, Ambassador Thomas Jr. said last year Zimbabwe exported goods worth $65 million to the United States.
It's in your favor, and we have normal trade relations. We'd like to see them expand, and that's why last year my distinguished predecessor, Ambassador Wharton, took a business delegation to the U.S.
Ambassador Thomas Jr. said he is working on improving trade between the two countries. Zimbabwe is America's 164th trading partner in the world. As for the targeted sanctions, Ambassador Thomas Jr. said the United States President Barack Obama and the U.S. Senate could only review them on the back of genuine economic and political reforms.
98 individuals, 68 entities. What will it take for the Senate and President of the United States have to be convinced that there is genuine economic as well as political reform? A good start would be an implementation of your constitution. It's the Zimbabwean people's constitution.
Ambassador Thomas Jr., who earlier met the visiting IMF delegation, said it was America's wish that the Zimbabwean government clarifies its economic policies and tackle corruption so as to attract meaningful investment.
We know that people are suffering, so we hope that the government's economic policies are clear, transparent, and will allow for direct investment. As I'm sure you know, that sanctions have nothing to do with Zimbabwe's inability to access the international financial institutions. Zimbabwe cannot access the international financial institutions because before sanctions were imposed, Zimbabwe stopped paying the international financial.
He said the United States remained Zimbabwe's biggest donor and had this year provided $55 million in food aid and security and was spending millions of dollars in fighting HIV/AIDS. Ambassador Thomas Jr. said, apart from Nigeria, Zimbabwe received more U.S. scholarships than any other country on the African continent. Ambassador Thomas Jr. also said he hoped the United States government would continue the Mandela Washington Fellowship for young African leaders even after President Obama leaves office next January. About 60 young Zimbabweans left the country today for the program. They will be attached to various universities and other institutions before meeting President Obama. From Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
2 weeks after an attack by the Islamist group Boko Haram left at least 30 people dead, the border community of Boso in Niger has become a ghost town. Most of its population left, and the area remains at risk to violence. For VOA, Emily Iob reports from Boso.
A shoe, a half-full suitcase thrown in the backyard, the house doors left open. Most residents of Boso left everything behind 2 weeks ago when the first gunshot rang through the town. Among them is El Haj Abba. Yes, we're scared. We don't have weapons, so it's normal to be scared, he says as he stands on top of his car, strapping a pile of belongings he can bring to the IDP camp he and his family now stay at. Abba is Nigerian. He fled to Boso in Niger after Boko Haram militants wreaked havoc in his home country only a few miles away. But the armed group has been attacking several neighboring towns in Niger as well in the past couple of years, forcing populations to move back and forth between towns and makeshift camps located in the bush. It is not the first time that Boso has been targeted. The most recent attack was on June 3rd. It was a Friday, just after 8 p.m., remembers resident Abdelaziz Zambada, who lived next to a police station that was targeted.
J'ai pris deux de mes enfants, madame a pris une. Le temps où on est sorti, le temps de revenir, c'est là où l'oubli est tombé.
I took one of my kids, my wife took two, he says. By the time we put them to safety and came back to fetch my daughter, a mortar hit my house. My neighbor's children and my daughter were killed. Officially, there were no civilians killed during the attack, only soldiers. But some bodies can still be found inside houses, and the smell of death is everywhere. Most of Boso's estimated 25,000 residents left town. Two-thirds were refugees and internally displaced persons. Alarmed residents in the general area also left their homes, leaving an estimated 50,000 people displaced. On a deserted market street, the decomposing body of a goat dries under the scorching sun next to a ransacked stall. There is no water, no electricity or phone network, and very little food left in town after Boko Haram looted most of it. But despite all that, resident Suleiman Salisa decided to stay. He says, "We can tell it's going better. Yesterday we heard gunshot, but we were not worried." Salisa says the heavy military presence reassured him, and as a hairdresser, they are his only customers. There are not a lot of people left. It's disheartening, he says. We would like more residents to come back, and we need assistance with food, water, and electricity. That day, an official delegation led by Interior Minister Mohamed Bazoum visited the town for the first time since the attack and organized a meeting to reassure the population.
Les militaires sont là, vous l'avez constaté, un effectif conséquent.
He says the soldiers are here in substantial number and with a new strategy and a renewed morale. The conditions are met for the population to feel safe and come back. But this will take time, as the Islamic group continues attacks along the border, terrorizing the population and harassing authorities. The day before, they attacked and looted a police station in a border town just moments after an official delegation had driven away. Emir Yab for VOA News.
It's a set time aside to appreciate dads and all they must do to raise happy, effective, and well-rounded children. However, as viewers Adam Phillips learned, a father's role and what he is expected to or refrain from doing differs between cultures and often must change when that dad immigrates to the U.S. or elsewhere in the West.
It's a sunny summer day in New York City, and the children in this playground are enjoying the sprinklers. There are as many fathers as mothers supervising the fun here. And at home, American dads are more involved with child-rearing than ever. Wayne Ho loves helping to care for his 8-month-old daughter, but his own father, an ethnic Chinese, was less involved while raising him and his brother after the family moved from Singapore to California.
When I was a baby, most of the parenting and changing diapers and feeding me was done by my mother. But I think it's more of an equal partnership with my wife and me. For example, my wife, every other weekend, she works full-time at a health clinic. So every other Saturday and Sunday for 12 hours, I'm by myself with my daughter. And we go to the park, we go around and play, and I'm having a lot of fun as a father.
Ho says being such an active parent puts constraints on his career that his father did not have.
That's what's been hard for me as a father because of my wife's work hours. On weeknights, I'm actually home early. I have to be home earlier than my wife. I have to leave my job earlier. I run a nonprofit organization during this tough economy, and I think it's hard to really do this work-life balance while raising a child. And I think that there's an added challenge because I want my daughter to get to know her extended family, and we don't have that here.
Those aunts, uncles, and cousins were part of his growing up, and so were Chinese traditions. Ho says his father took instilling that heritage very seriously. He and his brother were not allowed to learn English until they were in kindergarten, and Chinese holidays were carefully observed.
During Lunar New Year, he would work with my grandmother and set up all the candles, the incense, the oranges, and the Chinese letters, and put it up in our home because we had to pay respects to our elders and ancestors.
Fathering American style often involves a lot more negotiation than it did in Moluso Bekele's childhood in Ethiopia, where he says a child's feelings were not as carefully considered as they are here.
Back home, you're given something, you just say thank you. Here it's like, would you like this? How would you like me to cook it for you? I mean, in a sense, it's nice to give your kids the option, but at times they tend to be spoiled with all the choices. Normally, in America, it's just a little lax.
But Bekele says that's not how it is with his 11-year-old son.
For me personally, it's very satisfying to be involved with my child and see him grow and change every single day. The conversations we have that I would never, ever imagine talking with my dad. About girlfriends and puberty and a whole bunch of stuff. It's incredible. It's great.
Bekele's own father was quite strict. In Ethiopia, he recalls, it was acceptable for fathers and even teachers to strike a child.
If a kid misbehaves, he can get whipped real good. Whipping is part of growing up. Whereas here, you could get in legal trouble if you touch your kid. Even the kids are aware that they should not be whipped. They would say, you know, oh, I'm going to call 911. On the other side, not being able to discipline your child when circumstance dictated is somewhat limiting.
Bekele feels lucky he hasn't had to use physical punishment with his son.
My relationship with him is good enough that he knows when he crosses the line. And I tell him, listen, you're crossing the line, that's it. You stop, and he stops.
Like their own more traditional fathers, both Moluso Bekele and Wayne Ho believe firmly in the benefits of education. They hope their children will enjoy great opportunities as second-generation immigrants. However, both also want their kids to be allowed to create their own futures in their own ways. As Ho puts it, following one's own star and working hard upholds a family's honor the American way. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
The World Health Organization is appealing for $121 million to combat the Zika virus over the next 18 months. The revised Global Strategic Response Plan supplants a previous plan launched in February, which requested around $20 million. For VOA, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The significant increase in the amount of money requested to tackle the Zika virus indicates the gravity with which the World Health Organization views this infection. The Zika virus, which is now circulating in some 60 countries worldwide, is linked to microcephaly, an infection that causes brain abnormalities in newborn babies, and Guillain-Barré syndrome, a neurological disorder. The epicenter of the disease is in Latin America. WHO spokesman Tarek Jazarevich says the response to Zika requires an integrated approach that places support for women and girls of childbearing age at its core.
This strategy will place greater focus on preventing and managing medical complications caused by Zika virus infection by providing counseling and treatment, if necessary, to pregnant women, partners, households, infected people, and will also work with communities trying to have enough of capacities at the health systems to provide a necessary support to communities.
The plan highlights several specific characteristics of the Zika outbreak that need special vigilance and a global response. They include the potential for further international spread of the Zika virus by Aedes mosquitoes. The WHO says a lack of immunity in areas where the Zika virus is circulating for the first time could allow the disease to spread quickly. It says the absence of vaccines, treatments, and rapid diagnostic tests, as well as inequalities in access to sanitation and health services in affected areas, are of concern and will require special care. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
Next on Let's Talk, dual citizenship. Would you consider acquiring the citizenship of another country? Join host Sunday Shumari and his guests discussing dual citizenship. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of your breakfast show, Daybreak Africa. As always, our newsroom is on top of the news of your interest. We provide you with up-to-the-minute news about Africa as well as world news. Tune in to our show right here on VOA Africa, your trusted source of news and information.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Shaka goes one-on-one with Linda Thomas-Greenfield. The Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of African Affairs is America's top diplomat to Africa. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 1830 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. And it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with football. Egyptian giants Al Ahly returned to the group stage of the Champions League for the first time in 2 years with a shock 3-2 defeat away to Zambia's Zesco United on Saturday. Ahly, the eight-time winners, coached by former Tottenham manager Martin Joe, were determined to make up for recent disappointments in Africa's Premier Club competition. But Zesco United, who have never got beyond the group stage, upset the Red Devils with a home victory in Indola. The hosts now go top of the standings. Also on Saturday in Group A, Wydad Casablanca, who knocked out the defending champions TP Mazembe in their playoff round, carried on their good form by winning 1-0 away to ASEC Mimosa of Ivory Coast in their opener. The Moroccans, who were runners-up the last time they competed in the competition in 2011, secured their victory thanks to a 39th-minute goal from Saleh Said. In Group B, South African champions Mamelodi Sundowns are still in contention following the disqualification of AS Vita Club, who fielded an ineligible player. The other match in the group sees two-time champions Enyimba at home in Port Harcourt to Zamalek, who have won the showpiece event of African football 5 times, although their last success dates back to 2002. The Egyptians, who travel to Nigeria with a new coach in Mohamed Halme after former Scotland coach Alex McLeish parted ways with the Cairo Giants after just 65 days, have all but lost the Egyptian title to rivals Al Ahly and now seek consolation from the Champions League. In the African Confederation Cup, defending champions Etoile du Sahel were beaten 2-1 by Kaukab Marrakech in Morocco on Friday at the start of the group stage of the competition. Etoile from Tunisia took the lead in the Group B match when Lama Hamza converted a penalty in the 62nd minute, but two red cards in the space of 2 minutes for the holders turned the game. Group B consists exclusively of North African clubs, with the other match this weekend featuring another Moroccan side, FUS Rabat, against Al Ahly Tripoli of Libya. In Group A, Madiema of Ghana believe they can overcome their financial difficulties and beat TP Mazembe in the DR Congo at the start of their group campaign. It is, however, a lofty ambition for the club battling to fund a trip from West Central Africa, as they have never won a Confederation of African Football competition, while their opponents can boast of having won 9 titles. Madiema must travel to DR Congo, Algeria and Tanzania in the group phase, and should they finish bottom of the standings, will receive only $150,000 prize money. Novices Malodia Beja of Algeria host vastly experienced young Africans of Tanzania in the other Group A match and are set to exploit home advantage and collect maximum points. Elsewhere, the World Soccer Governing Body, FIFA, has cautioned the Ugandan government against forcing the country's football association, FUFA, to register as a trustee, which FIFA says would be considered an interference. In a letter to both FUFA and the Ugandan government, FIFA warned of possible sanctions if the FA registers under the government's Trustee Incorporation Act. This comes after Uganda's government gave all Ugandan sporting federations a deadline of June 30th to register. Any possible sanctions, which could involve a world ban, would hurt the Cranes, who are on the brink of qualification for the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations, and a victory over Comoros in September will take them to the finals in Gabon. They are also the only nation in the CECAFA region still involved in the 2018 FIFA World Cup qualifiers. Finally, in rugby, South Africa staged a stirring comeback in the second test in Johannesburg to square the three-match series. 14-man Ireland prevailed in Cape Town last weekend and led 19-3 at halftime at Ellis Park. But the Springbok replacements injected much-needed urgency, and the hosts eventually outscored Ireland 4-2 to deserve their victory. Ireland were chasing a first series win in South Africa, but could still make history in Port Elizabeth next weekend. If Ireland do win at Nelson Mandela Bay Stadium, they will also be the first of the four home nations to win a test series in South Africa. And that's it for this edition of Netland Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. Enjoy.
Only your legs,
only your
you're my African queen. Ooh, Lord, ooh, Lord. Just like the sun light up the earth, you light up my life. The only one I ever see with a smile so bright. Hey, and just yesterday, you came around my way. You changed my whole sin weight with your astonishing beauty. Oh, you couldn't make a brother sing. No ordinary thing, a supernatural being. And oh, you are brighter than the moon, brighter than the star. I love you just the way you are. And you are my African queen, the girl of my dreams. You take me where I've never been, yeah. You make my heart go ting-a-ling-a-ling. Oh, you are my African queen, the girl of my dreams. And you remind me of a thing, and that is the African beauty, yeah. You are my African queen. Oh, Lord, ooh, Lord. Out of a million, you stand as one, the outstanding one. I look into your eyes, girl, what I see is paradise. Hey, you captivated my soul. Now every day I want you more. I cannot deny this feeling I'm feeling inside. Hey, no one cannot take your place. You cannot take your space. That is a fact I cannot erase. And no, you are the one that makes me smile. Make me float like a boat upon the Nile. Girl, you are my African queen, the girl of my dreams. You take me where I've never been. You make my heart go ting-a-ling-a-ling. Yeah, you are my African queen, girl of my dreams. And you remind me of a thing, yeah. And that is the African beauty, yeah. Oh, 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 yeah, yeah. Ooh, you are my African queen. And I know, oh yes, I know. You are my African queen, and I know, see I know, see I know what I am feeling in my heart and in my soul. Oh, I know that it is love, and I know that this love was surely sent from up above. Cause you're the only one that I think of. You are my African queen, and I know that this means that you.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. China is on the march in Africa. Concerted efforts in some segment of the global media to convince Africa that China has embarked on a neo-colonialism of Africa has failed. It is possible that some Africans have believed that myth, but we must not forget what colonialism was in Africa. European powers had come into that continent, sometimes with some gifts, some arms, small arms, and they have hoodwinked the leaders of Africa. And it is by that means that they occupied almost all of the continents. Colonialism is also a fact that at the Berlin Conference, European powers sat together with a map without any African presence and partitioned Africa for their colonial rule. China has done nothing of the sort. China has tried since the victory of the Communist Party in China to relate with Africa. And the Chinese have never forgotten the role that Africa played in its gaining of its rightful place in the United Nations in 1971. China has also emerged as a major economic power. And despite resistance by the International Monetary Fund, IMF, the IMF succumbed and agreed to make the Chinese currency yuan as one of the reserve currency for special drawing rights. This is a major, major victory for China in terms of its economy and finance. It will facilitate its dealing with many countries, particularly in Africa. Shortly after that news was announced by the IMF, the president of China, Xi, visited the major country in Africa, Zimbabwe, whose leader has found himself in great hot water with European countries. And after the meeting in Zimbabwe, Xi proceeded to Pretoria in South Africa for the China-African Summit. That summit advanced China's relationship with Africa in the economic and financial sense, and one can say that relationship, which goes back into Bandung in 1955 until the present, has now matured. In the speech by President Xi, he gave a 10-point plan, and that 10-point plan came to a figure of $60 billion credit line that will deal with a whole array of economic matters dealing with infrastructure, with economic assistance, with loan grants, and this will be the basis of the further development in the relationship between China and Africa. Now, it opts to the African countries themselves to see how best they can go forward with this relationship. But there will be attempts, as in the past, to warn some Africans, and some of them may fall into the trap. But what Africans must see is the genuine help of Africa to a continent which is in the field of poverty. China has given the way, and hopefully Africa will learn from China on how it managed to develop its economy and to lift its people out of poverty. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sally, Reporter Douglas Impuga, Producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. I remember, as the elders say, every lizard lies on its belly, so we cannot tell which one has a belly ache. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In a significant move to protect one of the world's most cherished species, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service this month completed a rulemaking process under the Endangered Species Act to institute a near-total ban on the domestic commercial trade of African elephant ivory. The rule, effective June 6th, fulfills restrictions outlined under President Obama's 2013 Executive Order on Combating Wildlife Trafficking. It substantially limits imports, exports, and sales of African elephant ivory across state lines. Wildlife trafficking reduces the economic, social, and environmental benefits of wildlife while generating billions of dollars for organized criminal enterprises, contributing to an illegal economy, fueling instability, and undermining security. The final rule prohibits most commerce in ivory, but makes specific limited exceptions for certain pre-existing manufactured items, such as musical instruments, furniture pieces, and firearms, that contain less than 200 grams of ivory and meet other specific criteria. Antiques, as defined under the Endangered Species Act, are also exempt from the prohibitions. This rule is limited to African elephant ivory and does not further regulate ivory derived from other species, such as walrus, whale, and mammoth. The new rule will provide federal agents with clearer lines of demarcation to identify illegal ivory. Desire for elephant ivory, mostly in Asia, is so great that it grossly outstrips the legal supply and creates a void in the marketplace that ivory traffickers are eager to fill. Perpetuating legal trade only serves to stimulate this consumer demand and further threaten wild elephant populations. During a recent 3-year period, an estimated 100,000 elephants were killed for their ivory, an average of approximately one every 15 minutes, and poaching continues at an alarming rate. The carcasses of illegally killed elephants now litter some of Africa's premier parks. Elephants are under threat even in areas that were once thought to be safe havens. Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell, who serves as co-chair of the President's Task Force on Wildlife Trafficking, said the United States hopes that other nations will act quickly and decisively to stop the flow of blood ivory by implementing similar regulations, which are crucial to ensuring our grandchildren and their children know these iconic species.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.